This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So I'm going to try to divide the time between me talking for like 20 minutes, and then we can have lots of questions. So in a word, I've been working, I spent the first half of my life basically immersed in Torah study. I got a smicha from Yeshiva University. I was a student of philosophy, like my mentor, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I grew up with Rabbi Soloveitchik in Boston, Massachusetts, but then I got my smicha from him. And so I combined philosophy and Talmud study and Torah study for the first half of my life. And I went on to get a PhD in philosophy and Jewish philosophy at Brandeis University. And at the time, I chose to write a dissertation on Shmuel David Lutzato, 1800 to 1865, who was the foremost biblical scholar of his generation in the Collegio Rabbinico, and wrote some very important books that were very unknown, on lectures on moral theology, and a book called Sefer Yesodei HaTorah that was foundational and path-breaking because it was an entire genre of philosophy in Judaism that was very Orthodox traditional and yet very path-breaking and different than the German schools. It was based on a certain school of philosophy that's not commonly done by the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition was heavily influenced by the medieval scholarly tradition and in turn by the Germanic tradition of philosophy of Kantianism and neo-Kantianism that was predominant in Eastern Europe. Lutzato was focused on a different approach to ethics and philosophy, and that was called moral sense theory, which was Hutchinson, Shaftesbury, and others. And I was fascinated by this, and I was fascinated in general by Italian Judaism and Italian traditional Judaism, which is very different in its boldness in traditionalism, like a lot of Sephardi thinking, but very, very unaffected by the bitterness of the polarized relationship between Jews and non-Jews in Eastern Europe that kind of has dominated most of the inheritance that we've had from the Ashkenazi tradition. So the Italians were different that way, a lot of Sephardic traditions, and Lutzato in one generation and Benamozzi in another in Italy pioneered a different approach that was simultaneously very halachic and very universal. And that easy combination of a family of the Jewish people and the family of humanity. So family within family. And so he preferred the English moral sense theory tradition, which was focused on pro-social moral sentiments. And this is before the scientific understanding that we have today of the brain. And my book now is an integration of the dissertation with a much more updated approach to neuroscience and neuroplasticity, which is the focus of a lot of my research and practice, because for the last 32 years, I've been a practitioner of peacemaking in this city, mostly, in those 32 years, but also in Syria and in Jordan and in other parts of the world, and I have students that come to me from different places. So my interest in Lutzato was that Lutzato basically... I'll pass it around, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, eventually I'm going to make some quotes from there, but
you can pass it around. Yeah, so people can.
Yeah, the book is, it's not going to be, I don't believe very much in paper publishing anymore, so I do this self-published through Amazon, so it is published on demand. It's very easy to get it through Amazon, but it's not going to be something you'll see easily in libraries. And it's an exhaustive analysis of the entire philosophical foundation of how Lutzato came to align moral sense theory together with a detailed analysis of Torah text, how he relates to Torah text, how he looks for the essentials of Torah text, and then how he deals with the rabbinic tradition. Because as a biblically centered scholar, he was very focused on the importance of the D'oraisa. You all know that, you know, expression of D'oraisa, but the D'rabbanan was to be taken very seriously, but the themes of the D'oraisa was paramount in terms of living the life of Derech Hashem, of living in the way of God. And for him, the foundational religion is not Mosaic religion, it's actually Abrahamic religion, which is Genesis 18:19, to walk in the path of Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, which is La'asot Derech Tzedek U'Mishpat, to do justice and righteousness. Over time, he centralized that into Chemla, Rachem Ugmol Shmayim, two principles. One was compassion, and the other one was the awareness of divine providence, or the awareness of a creator, the awareness of somebody or something in the world that says that your actions matter, that there are consequences to your actions. And he was in opposition to a large atheistic or pantheistic direction of Spinoza and others that was removing a sense of otherness and accountability to the world. So his main notion is that altruism is the core of service to God. And his basic reason for coming to that conclusion, and that's why, for example, as you know, Koheles, he studied at 21, he was a real prodigy. At 21, he had already written a major work on Koheles, on Ecclesiastes. His major conclusion from the book of Koheles was, indeed, Hakol Havel, and you know it's a heretical work, and it was included in the Bible, and that's the big question for everybody. Well, what's a heretical work doing in the Bible? He said, indeed, the purpose of the book is everything is vanity, everything is pointless, if you live your life selfishly. If you live your life without altruism. And so his this is something that for him became an intellectual direction of living with poor people, growing up in the countryside with poor people, and then the hardship is of his own life. Because he bore a number of children, and he lost almost every one of them. And he had two wives, two sisters. They both died of depression because of the loss of the children. So he was very, very poor. So both the premature loss of children, the poverty, grinding poverty, all of these things made him soul search, what is the essence of life? And what cannot be taken away from you? And so he argued that in terms of ethics, the only thing that can't be taken away from you is your ability to care for another, your ability to have compassion. And that and amazingly, and you know, he comes to this conclusion in 1860, but in 1950, Viktor Frankl in Man's Search for Meaning comes to exactly the same conclusion. And Frankl never knew from Luzzatto. Frankl didn't know much about his Jewish background, but Frankl's conclusions from the Holocaust and from the concentration camp is that our humanity is tied up with the ability to care. And that's where you define your humanity, and that's the one thing that no one can ever take away. So this was very much a life calling for Luzzatto, and it was very much an argument that it's the core of Judaism, the core essence of Judaism. And the reason why, as a biblical scholar, he was the foremost biblical scholar of his generation. He was famous throughout Europe. And to this day, many people in the Torah commentaries, they'll see the precise linguistics. His Hebrew was extraordinary. And he just went to the core and he said, what are the texts that are the most frequently known? How would you define what it is to be Jewish? What is said again and again and again? What is the mitzvah that is the most frequently mentioned?
To love your neighbor, to love the stranger.
Not love your neighbor, but love the stranger. B'ahavta re'acha kamocha is said like once, Leviticus 19, I think.
I meant the stranger.
But b'ahavta me'asager is mentioned at least 33 times throughout the Torah, and then sometimes given a deeper explanation that then ties into the ritual cycle of the year, which is because you were strangers in the land of Egypt, and then most importantly, ba'atem yedatem es nefesh hagir, because you know the heart of the stranger. And then there's many, many other related laws that are focused on the crime of cruelty. So for Luzzatto, and then if you go to the beginning of the Torah in the Genesis stories of what is the cardinal sin and the mistake of the generations that the God in those narratives decides to destroy, he argues it's compassion. And then if you go to the end of the Torah with Amos and Malachi, etc., is the ultimate condemnation of the Jewish kingdoms and the Jewish kings and the priesthood is that lack of compassion for the poor. So from the legalistic core to the narrative at the beginning to the narrative and prophecy at the end, Luzzatto sees that compassion is the goal. And then he has, you know, the book goes to a very detailed analysis of Tamei HaMitzvos, of the reasons of the commandments, and systematically he demonstrates that this core, but it's based on a very different approach than you would find in Ashkenazi, rather polarizing halacha today, or in the last few hundred years, and that is that the Ashkenazi halachic system is very much in a John Austin positivist notion that commandment is commandment precisely because it's almost Kierkegaardian, precisely because it's absurd. I want the most absurd mitzvahs, you know. I mean, this is where Kierkegaard came in together with this notion of do it because you're told, which is a very harsh father concept of Judaism and a harsh father concept of religion per se. And he was opposed to all of that. He said, that's not Jewish. And he proves it text by text by text. That the heart of Judaism is the love of humanity as part of the family of humanity, with a few special mitzvot for the family of the Jewish family, including no charging of interest and interest-free loans, etc., etc. He has about seven exceptions. And then the big exception, and the thing that everybody fell down on in terms of Jewish ethics, and its universal possibility, is Amalek. Is the idea that you should wipe out an entire nation. And you know, to this day, the genocidal laws of the Bible are basically responsible for the entire Abrahamic tradition, from Judaism, Christianity, to Islam, to have a tremendous amount of blood on its hands when an inferior people, quote-unquote, are labeled, you know, the work of the devil, or Amalek, or something that needs to be wiped out. That was the basis for the Indians being wiped out. Every genocide that the Abrahamic family has done is based on these. Nobody has a good explanation. And Luzzatto, as I write and I critique, and I said it fell down. You know, he said that it was a lesson in history that when absolute evil comes, that it should be wiped off the earth, and it was part of divine providence. You can judge for yourself as you look at the text. The key is this. What looks like a nice, interesting 19th century framing of Jewish tradition turns out to be the cutting edge of what we understand today in neuroplasticity and science. So look at the word neuroplasticity. What we know of the brain now is that the brain is far more plastic than we've ever understood before. And that plasticity is both good news and bad news for the fate of humankind. The good news is that it's incredibly easy to train people to be more compassionate, to be more responsible, to be more self-controlled. But it takes a consciousness from day one of the kind of habits of what you do with your hands and what you do with your words and what you do with your mind. So for Luzzatto, all the halachas of Lashon Hara, all of those halachas were part of mind training and habit training. And that it's a lifelong process of basically being an Eben Hashem, a servant of God, working on your brain. That turns out to be cutting-edge neuroscience today. And it's, you know, it's... he thought he was opposed to Kant, but as I study the neuroscience, the truth is that the neo-Kantian approach and the consequentialist approach and the moral sense approach all have their elements of how the mind is conditioned. So halacha, the idea of a halacha and a repetition of halacha every day and a repetition of the concept is a way of making a neural pathway that becomes stronger and stronger. And Luzzatto, prefiguring John Dewey and many others, understood that the key to righteousness and the key to social change, the key to society, is the habituation of the mind toward the good. And it's very hard, and there's many failures, but it is the practice of every word that you choose, every thought that you have, and everything that you do that makes society move in one direction or another. Conversely, we understand that plasticity is that if you have a terrible leader and they consistently say something, some word, like, for example, they continue to use the word, you know, the Jew is the parasite of society. And if you say it again and again and again and again and again, then the Jew becomes the parasite. And in fact, it's so strong that people act like that sometimes to reinforce because it's so compelling. So if you say that politician and you find a name, I had a classmate. This isn't being recorded, right?
It is being recorded.
Okay, I didn't have a classmate.
Somebody else had a
I knew somebody in another part of the school that was completely unrelated to my class. Who he had a habit of naming everybody he called them a name. And of course, he was also handsome and tall, and everybody liked him and wanted to like him, but he had a name. And those names stuck to everyone. And once they had their name, they were stuck with a name like, a bad name, like Oily, for a girl that, you know, he said her hair was oily. So she had to go through high school with everybody calling her that name because that person said that. That's the power of the brain. That's the power of Lashon Hara, of Motzi Shemra. That's conversely. But in the converse is that it's also good news. Because with every positive frame that you can use with your brain, you develop an altruistic personality, a compassionate personality, you know, etc. So I'll give you an example from my work. I've worked in very tense places. You know, I was in the middle of the Intifada. I was in the Mukata with Arafat. I was scared out of my mind. I was with Assad in Syria, and I was the only Jew for hundreds of miles and round, and I, you know, at least in Ramallah, I was just a few miles away, you know, but this was really, really scary work. And every time when I came up with somebody who was difficult and I was afraid of what was going to happen, I started naturally, before I read neuroplasticity, but following Lutzado, I would start doing in my mind, I would say, Who is the courageous one? He who can convert an enemy into a friend, which is a very radical, subversive, rabbinic critique of heroism. Because who is the gibor in the Bible?
Who kills an enemy?
Shimshon HaGibor, right? You know, the big guy that he's so strong he can bring down a building, Shimshon HaGibor. And the rabbis say, Ezehu gibor, who's a real hero? The person who can make an enemy into a friend. Who's a real hero? The person who can conquer their worst instincts. And so I would repeat this as a mantra when I was about to meet a difficult person. And I just did it up in the Temple Mount when I was just there, you know, a half hour ago. Because in Temple Mount, I'm here with a class. I do interventions between Palestinians and Israelis for 30 years. So I take my class, and they went up to the Temple Mount. And, you know, it's always a little bit tense up there. There were three people there being guarded by all the police with their heavy machine guns because they had all the long side girls and they were not allowed to speak, but they were, and they were moving backwards from the Temple Mount the Dome of the Rock, and my daughter and I were watching this situation, and then a man in full white, clearly Muslim, comes up to me, and I say, I'm agitated, you know, and I say, Salaam alaikum. And that's, you know, it's very important because even that, his eyes lit up. Because what's this Westerner, what's this Jew saying, Salaam Alaikum? And he immediately said, welcome, Ahlan wa Salaam. You know, everyone is welcome here, and his heart opened. And then he immediately started giving his philosophy his life. He said, all of this it all belongs to all of us because we're all from God, from one God. And he does this thing with his sign, with his hand, one God. It's like, all I did was open up a little bit to him, you know, and he did the same thing from 32 years ago. The first thing I ever did to cross enemy lines was right there, a few hundred feet away, in the Shuk, on the way to the Kotel. It was the day or two after Kahana had come in and had smashed all of the stores. It was in 1984, and I came through. And I looked at a man in a very, very old, poor Arab man in his stall. He had half his teeth gone, you know, and it wasn't clean shaven. I just looked at him, and I think he knew that I was apologizing because of the way I looked. And then he said, he pointed like this. And then I pointed like this. That's it. And then he said, Ibrahim, Father Ibrahim, Ibrahim. So, this is it. This is the training of the mind that Chazal and the Gemara and the Talmud and the Chazal and the prophets can give us. Is that the answers are right there. It's cutting-edge neuroscience. Is that we have the mantras. As much as I love many Buddhist philosophers and ideas and the Dalai Lama, we already have the mantras. We have them right, and Lutsado understood that. He understood that if you repeat again and again, Mahu Racham Avatafan, how, you know, do you know that particular rabbinic verse? What is knowledge of God? So in the Talmud, and Lutzada loved this because he was kind of an anti-metaphysicist. He said that this is the divine science. The true divine science is to be God-like. But we don't have a notion of what it is to be God-like if God is to the vast ends of the universe. To be God-like is compassion. Mahu chanun afata chanun. And he says specifically that the Gemara does not say mahu gibor afata gibor. Just as he is endlessly powerful, so should you be endlessly powerful. He particularly picks these qualities that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and many others were trying to emphasize as long-term Jewish survival. That true Jewish nationalism, that true Jewish survival, which has carried us for 2,000 years, is an internal certainty of what it is to live on this earth in a way that is not just for ourselves, but to be, as Rabbi Soloveitchik would always say, a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, which is a kahuna. The idea of kahuna is service. The idea of kahuna is purity within the community. And that was the destiny to try and aspire to be a kahuna for humanity. And even though that often puts you at risk for getting killed because of wars and jealousies and hatreds of others, that becomes a way of life that nothing can conquer. So from Lutzado to Frankl to some of the things we know from neuroscience today, this is a very powerful mind control and mind education that's internal, not based on cult, not based on manipulation, but based on your own internal evolution towards a greater and greater divine consciousness, which for Lutzado was discovering God within the face of the other. I think there's a statement in the Gemara that if you give a pruta, if you give even a pruta to a poor person, Zoho Makabel Pnei Hashem, right away. That if you give even a penny to the poor, immediately you see the face of the divine. For the philosophers and ethicists of Jewish history like Lutzado, this was the key to divine revelation. This was the key to the divine life. And you'll see in the book, if you want to read it, how he went through every single Jewish source on what kind of fulfilled Jewish life that means. For me, it became a vehicle of conflict resolution. Because as opposed to mediation and all of the things we do on face-to-face dialogues or problem-solving, a lot of the hardest things in life are meeting enemies in very strange spaces. Like at 12 o'clock at night on the border between Syria and Jordan, you know, being interrogated by a guy from the Foreign Service there. You know, that's, you know, you have to have, that's a moment where, you know, laws and conflict resolution processes, they're not going to help you much. It's going to be every word that you say is going to determine where things are going to go. You know, especially if you hear something, you know, even up at the Temple Mount today, it was extraordinary. And a couple of surprises, and you always have to be receptive and honest. A couple of reversals today. Elad, our saintly guide, who's one of the pioneering peacemakers here, Elad Vazana, and did work with you for 20 years. Elad's just playing around with one of the border guards, the Jewish border guards that was before we went into the mosque. So he's got the big machine gun. My people are very nervous, and he's tough with what he's saying, but he turns out he had a great sense of humor, and he was just sort of kidding with us. And so Elad starts chatting them up, and they knew each other from before. His name was Yitzi. And before you know, we're really friends with Yitzi. And it just changed the reversal of the imagery that some of my students have of people who serve here in the army. I go up, however, onto the mount, and I'm sitting with my daughter, and there's this guy barking orders on the Temple Mount. He's Arab. He represents the Waqf, and he's very nervous. He's saying, go here, you have to go here, you have to go here. And another Arab man comes over and says, you know, it matters how you say things, and he doesn't mean it. You know, he immediately made me feel, you know, better. And later on, he gave a talk to my entire group in his cafe when we were having a coffee with him. So even there, in these moments, you know, I never would have met that man if I didn't say salam alaikum. He never would have been nice to me and explained why that guy was barking at me if we hadn't broken. And every one of these things. What's the statement about jumping first to give shalom to somebody?
It's numerous.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a positive mitzvah to jump first to say, and you see this in Syria and Jordan, everywhere I go, people jump first to say salam alaikum. And then once you say that, they try to come in even more. Ahlan wa sahlan. And then there's all these other things, and people will greet each other for like 10 minutes, you know, with all these different statements. That's very Abrahamic. So with all of the other insanity of the dictatorships and the failed governance across the Middle East, with all the other failings of the Muslim and Arab world, there are these old, old instincts that are very much in our tradition too. They're very embedded, and they can be a bridge between us, and one of them is jumping to greet.
Yeah, we're learning it right now in my class.
What?
We're learning it right now in my class.
Yeah.
We're in the class where I'm the stuff that gets
it. Yeah.
Issue,
yeah.
And we're learning that with Midar Kei Shalom that you're supposed to greet someone first.
Yeah. So I'm going to stop there. I'm 5 minutes over. And I just want to get some of your impressions, and then I can respond, because I know you have a very short time frame until 2:20. So what is it?
2:25.
2:25. So just tell me your name and go ahead.
Nadi. I wanted to ask you, so, did he also have response? Is he just up there, or did he also tell people, answer questions of people what to do? And if he does that, do you see in his response that the way it trickled down into actual practice is here?
So it's a good question. I mean, I think the Italian tradition did not have as much the responsa tradition as much as some of the others. He was a professor of the rabbinic students for 40 years, but he didn't guide halachically. He preferred to focus on broader interpretive issues, study issues, and ethical issues. So he has thousands of letters of correspondence with the leading lights of the generation, but I couldn't find so much halachic response to literature. I mean, I think his whole mission, it's a good question, I think his whole mission was to try and reorient Jews towards, and Shomer Shabbos Jews, towards what's the overarching goal of your spiritual life every day? What is the big mitzvah every day? And then people work that out in terms of their interpretations. And frankly, Rabbi Soloveitchik also was very radical in ways that people don't know. He did not like to write responsa. He was opposed to the literature because he felt ultimately the person needs to study, and then practice, and then be ready for the complexity of life and to make those decisions within that moment. So even as a halachic authority, and Soloveitchik was a halachic authority for thousands, he would not write down his responsa. He wanted it to be what both of them, Lusato and he, called makom uzman, time and space specific, which was the most accurate and the most compassionate to the people involved. So Soloveitchik, like Lutzado, was trying to balance all the time overarching principles being as lenient as possible, which is a mitzvah in the Gemara, contrary to the atmosphere we see today, that it's a mitzvah to make it easy to be religious. And then, at the same time, what's the non-negotiables? Like, where's the Doraisa? But then what about dignity? And what about humiliation? And what about this and that? And you have to do that in the moment. So I think Lutsado was trying to get people to, in the realm of mitos, to focus. Similar to, well, yeah.
I think that's
it. Yes?
I was wondering if you could clarify what exactly you think the role of modern neuroscientific findings have on what you're saying, as yes. specifically neuroscientific, because, like, as opposed to social psychology, which might have described, like, the example you gave of one person who's popular gives other people names, and the other people go along with that.
So it turns out that there's a spectrum of things that are working in terms of the importance of the brain, and in terms of the training of the brain. That have led to a greater appreciation of two things, compassion and reason, as the keys to nonviolence. Steven Pinker wrote a very important book tracing the entire history of violence and the decrease in violence and the social psychological foundations of that. And he came to the conclusion, based on thousands of aggregated articles before this neuroscience came out, that compassion is the key to nonviolence, and that also reason. So for both Lutsado and the others, Lutsado was a moral intuitionist, and he was very angry at Spinoza and the others, Maimonides. He was an opponent of Maimonides because too much focus on reason and intellect leaves everyone else out. And Lutsado wanted a truly universal ethics that applied to everybody in all places, and like Viktor Frankl and others. Even though, in the end of the day, true elevation of society in a political sense requires not just compassion, but the translation of that compassion for all into rules. And rules need reason. So the key of psychological research has moved in that direction. Further than that, today, the neuroscience that was not as studied by Steven Pinker and others, but is now being studied by Olga Klemecki in Switzerland and other places, is that compassion appears to be the major emotion that is triggered when people are benevolent. And that it doesn't have one place in the brain, it has a series of places, and that it is conditioned easily by meditation and by other things. You can literally think yourself into cruelty or think yourself into compassion. And it starts to explain how Stanley Milgram could make a group of otherwise normal Yale University graduates into barbarians and Nazi soldiers within a matter of minutes. How the hell is that possible? Well, it turns out it is. We have to just deal with it. And we have to deal with it by training, by having minds that are trained enough to be able to say no to somebody that orders you to torture somebody else. And we're primitive at this stage. We haven't begun to internalize how much we have to work on our minds to create a less violent society. And that's where neuroscience is very exciting, because we know the amygdala. The post-World War II psychologists knew how powerful our instincts are for fight and flight based on anxiety and nervousness, and why racism is such a compelling thing for the brain. But they didn't research enough how that can be counteracted by altruism and compassion leading to higher reason. And that's why you see in many ultra-violent situations where the men are basically organized into many, many different gangs, like in Somalia or in many, many cities, is that the men end up in this tribal structure of war that is, there's no place in the brain to move. Whereas the women, who are often removed from that fight and flight, constant revenge cycle, can make relationships and then sometimes create groups beyond that because of the compassion between them. And it's not to say women aren't capable of barbarism, they are, but there is a greater incidence of the non-combatant women in the situation creating those bridges of compassion that then lead to rational thinking. So ironically or paradoxically, women are accused of being irrational for thousands of years, as you know from even Talmudic literature. It turns out that in many battle situations, the women dafka are the more rational ones in terms of basic human needs, family needs, food, etc. They don't burn food when the Romans are coming. But we have some people in Jewish history who did. But the rabbis, who were actually quite effeminate, they said, you know, let's take Yavne. Let's not fight to the last man and go down with the Beis HaMikdash. Let's survive. And that actually was a higher reasoning and a greater compassion. And we're here because Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made the choice for Yavne. We wouldn't be here. Most other sects, you know, died out once the Romans were, you know, killed. Yeah.
How do you deal with the realistic phenomena that people are the most compassionate with their in-group, mm-hmm. and so call them just the opposite with people who are not, they don't consider
exactly.
outsiders.
Exactly. So the strongest critique of Luzzatto's moral sense theory ethics focused on compassion is the fact that compassion, we understand now in terms of the brain, is possible. I have many, many books, and my first books on what goes wrong in the Middle East and in this region is that it's not that people don't have enough compassion, it's that they have too much compassion for their own group. I mean, in many ways, the people who started the Nazi Holocaust had too much love for Aryans. And they were convinced that the Jews had to be killed because they were a threat to the mortal existence of the future of the Aryan people. Many, many white nationalists in America now are being persuaded that the white race is about to be killed and die. And out of love for their neighbors, they are willing to follow some people into hell. So compassion by itself, and this is where Luzzatto should not have critiqued Immanuel Kant as strongly as he did, because it turns out we need both. We need compassion, but we need the rule of law to apply that compassion to all. Our reason, I'll give you an example. If you're just, you know, a wild Rousseauian compassionate person, and you just, you know, you can go crazy, you can get extra violent. But if I'm compassionate for you, and then I'm going to an enemy and I feel compassion for them, and this drives me crazy for 30 years, going back and forth between the sides here, and you feel it, and you really feel it, the thing that comes to you is not, oh, overflowing happy compassion. It's actually a pretty horrible experience. You move towards reason. You say, there have to be rules. What are the rules that we could all live by so that everybody could be compassionate? What is it going to take? So that's the weakness in focusing exclusively on compassion. And I critique Luzzatto at the end of the book, because really the combination that's beautiful is between a Kantian commitment to law, halacha, both universal and particular, combined with an emotional training of empathy for the other. Those two are a powerful thing. And Steven Pinker comes exactly to the same conclusion in Better Angels of Our Nature, of where nonviolence is coming from. Why are people less prone now to enjoy burning cats in public or burning black people in public? Why was that a big barbecue festival just 100 years ago in Virginia? Big festival. You bring your kids to watch a black man burn to death screaming. And now, can't even imagine, right? They used to enjoy it. So both the films, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, many, many other things, started to infect the consciousness of white people. So they couldn't... You can't do that after reading Tom Sawyer. You see, so books, movies, stories, relationships, they destroy your ability to enjoy someone else's suffering. And then from there, you need to figure out what the hell to do. And we're actually still there. A lot of people have compassion. They don't know what to do about politics. None of us know what to do about power politics or corruption, or the influence of money and power, or the use of racism, hatred to polarize. Where would the Iranian regime be without the evil empire of the great Satan and the little Satan? Where would Saudi be without the other that is non-Wahhabi? Where would the Jews be if there wasn't a Palestinian enemy? We would be at each other's throats. because we haven't solved that question of how to have political and military power without an enemy. How are you strong without an enemy? So all of these things, we're still beginning, but the first stage is evoking compassion. That has tended to make it harder and harder to torture homosexuals, to do many, many things that we used to do. We can still disagree about abortion, we can disagree about homosexual lifestyle, we can do all sorts of things, say, no, that's not for me, or that's not my halacha, but you just can't enjoy the pain of another once you've seen the movie Philadelphia. You just can't. So I remember Philadelphia. It was like a watershed in American culture. It was amazing what Tom Hanks did in one movie to remove the ability to make fun of homosexuals. I grew up making fun of homosexuals. Everybody did. You can't after you see that movie. So this has been a key. But then we have to move it into the rule of law and governance and, you know, how we get along. Somebody hasn't spoken. Sorry. Yes.
Where in the Jewish world today do you see compassion being a guiding factor in how the image of Judaism is projected and practiced today? If such a thing exists.
There are hundreds of Jewish groups and Jewish individuals that are doing amazing things in many parts of the world. You know, we don't have a Dalai Lama, or we don't have a Pope Francis, because we're not organized that way. We're very fractionated, highly independent people, but we have individuals who are doing, you know, my friend Aryeh Cohen is on the streets of Los Angeles all the time. He's a professor of rabbinics at the Shomer Shabbos, and he's on the streets with the illegal immigrants all the time. And the Kiddush Hashem is incredible. And that, the gesture of basically putting yourself at risk for a group that you have no reason to put yourself at risk at, these are the kind of examples. Heschel did this and many others. So we're tiny people. Nonprofits are not very profitable, obviously. And so, you know, if we boil down to what I call individual exemplars. I have a book called Bridges Across the Impossible Divide, and I focus on exemplars. You know, Palestinians are also tiny people, totally fractionated in ways you can't even imagine. You just have to go back to exemplars. There's nobody in the world like Sheikh Bukhari. He wasn't even considered a Palestinian because he was here 400 years from Bukhara. But, you know, everybody on the west side saw him as Palestinian. But Palestinians didn't see him as Palestinian. But nevertheless, an exemplar of a Sufi with absolute love in his heart. Radical, radical guy. You know, he didn't care one way or the other. He said, you know, somebody prays five times a day, but they have hate in his heart. He said, that's not a Muslim. You know, and he practiced, he sacrificed, he gave up his life with five heart attacks. He died on his way to go to plead with Erdogan because he was a Turkish, his family related to the Ottoman emperor, the Ottoman sultans all those centuries. He went and he had a meeting with Erdogan, died on his way because of the attack on the Marmara, the ship. And everyone canceled the meeting and so on. You know the whole story. But I mean, these are, you know, Lamed Vavniks, we call them. These are the Nistar, the hidden gems of humanity, and they're all there. But you're not always going to see it in a big organized way. We don't have a billion members so that Catholicism can have the community of St. Egidio totally dedicated to poverty work, right? You know, and they're all over the world. I think there's 30 million of them. You know, it's like 30 million? What's that as a Jew, you know? But it's just, you know. So we have it. It's there. But you have to look for it in extraordinary individuals. Last question.
Okay. In the conversations that you've been a part of between Israelis and Palestinians, I was wondering which comments or sentiments from Israelis to Palestinians and Palestinians to Israelis have led to the most internal change on the side of the receiver?
Yeah, the people who've... okay, this is a very important question. I'll do it very briefly, because I've been studying this for 30 years, watching what works and what doesn't work. What doesn't work? Well, this is where Danny and I have... Danny's experimenting with something different, and that's principled argumentation. And it's very powerful work, and I think it's also very important for Jewish people who like arguing to have a constructive approach to argumentation. That's not what I've seen work between Jews and Palestinians. What I've seen work between Jews and Palestinians is the receptivity to someone's story, the focus on family and origins, questions rather than answers, sleeping in somebody's house, eating food. And sometimes just, Ezum Muchubara, Machabedes Abrios, the who is honored, he who honors the other being. Honor is so important in fights over humiliation. And so that moment of honor leads to these breakthroughs that are just magical. Just magical. You can see people transform in a minute when you say something just totally unexpected, generous, and even more if you sleep in the house. I mean, the life-changing moment for my life was in 1984 at Neve Shalom when I slept in a house of an Arab man who now has written a book that I helped write because I was terrified in 1984 in a 20-something sleeping in an Arab's house. As happens, I'm going to be killed. It turns out that everywhere you go in the world, people are afraid they're going to be killed at night when they sleep. And if a Muslim and Christian, imam and pastor in Nigeria, They became peacemakers after being warriors, but they confessed to me that even when they were going out speaking for peace in Switzerland, one of them said, you know, maybe I should kill him tonight.
Put the pillow over his
head. I swear to God, he said, maybe I should kill him. Because this is... So when you sleep together with people, something magical happens because you're totally vulnerable to death. And you are half dead. And then you come alive, and you're still there. So there's a lot of really interesting ways in which Palestinians and Jews have created moments of love and solidarity. And I read about it in Bridge Across the in the Bridges book. And then everything changes, and then all the crap around them doesn't affect that depth of love, and then they can become partners. Okay.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.